Everyone's asleep.
Exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the fabulous, the fluoridated, the Fukushima irradiated. Of course, we don't know any about that because the government stopped testing for it halfway through last year. My very special guest today is Michael J.S. Carter, the Reverend Michael J.S. Carter, and we're going to have a little bit of reverence for him. Welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure, Vincent. I've been looking forward to this all day.
Can you tell us a little bit about who you are?
Yes, I am an ordained interfaith minister. I went to one of the top prestigious seminaries in the country. I graduated from Union Theological Seminary in New York City. I now serve a church, a Unitarian Universalist congregation here in the mountains of Western North Carolina. Moved here from New York City 8 years ago this July, originally from Baltimore, Maryland, have a lovely 8-year-old and a wonderful wife.
And what is it you teach to your congregation? You say there's multiple faiths kind of like slided together. How does that work?
Exactly. Basically, the truncated version is this. Unitarian Universalism is a faith that broke away from the Protestant Reformation. It came to these shores from Europe. Unitarians believe in the unity of God, thus the prefix uni, Unitarian, one. Universalists believe that, and this is generally speaking, that God would not barbecue someone because God is love. And so we've branched out from our Christian roots. My congregation, they're atheists, there are agnostics, there are people who don't know and don't care, there are people who are more Buddhist in their orientation. The similarity is that they've all broken away from traditional Orthodox Christianity.
So you're kind of like the opposite of one of those Jewish rabbis with the big beards and the curls on the side of the head. You're unorthodox.
Yes, exactly. We are what people would call liberal Christians, or not liberal Christians, but there are Christians there. We are free thinkers, for lack of a better word. But we do call our building a church. We sing hymns. We have prayer and meditation. We just don't adhere to the party line, as it were.
So kind of like everybody takes personal responsibility. They believe whatever they want, but they kind of walk with God anyway, yeah?
Yes, if they believe in God. Our motto is, you don't have to think alike to love alike.
Well, that seems about right.
Yeah.
What's the rest of the organized religion's problem? Money?
You know, I think it's money, but I also think it's the
Scumbaggery?
No, no, because I know good people who are people of faith. I don't want to paint all of them with the same brush.
I know good people who work at McDonald's. It doesn't mean McDonald's is lovely.
No, no, but if that works for you, it works for you. I try to be more inclusive, and I just don't. The reason I left is because of the us versus them attitude, and I don't want to fall victim being the same people that I had to leave from. I think that a lot of people were indoctrinated, and sometimes it's more difficult to unlearn something than it is to learn something new.
Well, I think that was something Mark Twain said. It's much easier to convince a man, convince a man of a lie than it is to convince him that he's been lied to.
Yes, that's very well put, as only Mark Twain could put it. But I also try to realize that, you know, I could be wrong too. But for me, it's about unity, and that doesn't mean giving up individualism. And so, for me, whatever your philosophy or religion is, If it's about division, then you may want to rethink it. If it's about bringing people together, then I'll toss my hat in the ring.
How many Satanists do you have in your congregation?
We don't have any that I know of.
Maybe they just don't like the whole idea of being included.
we don't have any that I know of. We have some people who identify as pagan. Some people have identified as witches, but we open our doors to that. We just, like I said, you know, if you're going to be about love, if you're going to be about how can we negotiate and navigate our differences on this planet, then we're open to you. Because we're open doesn't mean that you can believe anything.
So what are the no-nos? Hurting people, pedophilia, that kind of thing. I presume those are like no-go areas.
Oh, no question. Of course, if you're going to deliberately or intentionally hurt the planet and those on the planet, of course, that's definitely a no-no. But we figure that people have to are self-responsible and that they have to kind of navigate their own way. We are there as a place to help nurture. I mean, we're certainly not telling anyone what they can believe, but coming to our church, let's say someone doesn't believe in God. We don't say, well, we need to pray for you or you've got a problem. We say, okay, what is it that you do believe in? What is it that does bring you joy? What is it that does nourish your interconnectedness to creation? That's what we're there for.
What's the most interesting answer you've had to that question?
Nothing that would knock me over. I mean, most people, this denomination has been in this country since the 1700s, well, Unitarianism since 1825, Universalism since the 1700s. I mean, most people want to have a sense of community. They want to live in as much as possible. They want to live in peace. They want to stand up for justice, whether it's racial justice or justice for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and questioning individuals. We do well. We do well.
And how exactly do you help people? I mean, let's say somebody's in a mode of spiritual crisis. You know, they've had their wife and child die in a car accident or something like that, and they're in grave trouble of losing their faith and even continuing on. What would you do for that person?
Well, what we do would be what any religious organization would do. We would be there to comfort them. We would be there to assist with them if they needed anything. We have a pastoral care program at our church, for instance. But as far as their faith would go, we would not say, well, you shouldn't lose your faith. Maybe this event in your life will help to either have a deeper faith or to change the way you believe. But we would never say, oh my God, you're going to lose faith. We got to help you with that. That's not our way.
Well, faith is quite difficult to lose. It's not exactly like a pair of car keys or something, you know, something really bad has to happen.
I mean, people have lost faith, but I lost faith in the God of my childhood, but I found a new faith.
Could you explain that experience to me? Because everybody's kind of got this wake up story where they change from one point of view earlier on in their life and then completely kind of do a turnaround, and an event usually causes it. Would you mind sharing yours?
Well, I think mine came gradually, except for when I had my visit from the star visitors, which I talk about in my book. But as I got older and I kind of got out of the little Baptist shell that I was raised in, and I started reading other philosophers and studying comparative religions and just using what I thought was my own curiosity, I started looking at what I was taught in a different way. That if this being that we call God is about love, then why is it that if people don't believe the same thing that I believe, that they're to be shunned or they're to be somehow denigrated, or at least not held in the same esteem as me? And that was something that just propelled me into saying, well, wait a minute, we know what all these books tell you. We know what some of these clergy are telling you. What is it that you believe, Michael? Follow your heart. And when I started branching out and studying metaphysics and what have you, I found people who were saying, it's okay to question. We can't give you an answer. That journey is your journey. But we can help nurture you. We can help support you. And that's how that happened for me. The right book came my way, or books, the right individual came my way. I had to do some work on myself to look at my own foibles, if you will. And it became gradual until December 28, 1989, when I had my first adult experience with these off-world intelligences. And then things started speeding up. I started living my life less fearfully. I started seeing the interconnectedness of really everything. I stopped focusing on what was separate and different about people and what made us all human. And so that's how that happened to me. It was gradual, at least up until the time I had my first visit. And then things really started speeding up.
Could you explain the visit?
Yes. On December 28, 1989, I had come back from a visit to the pyramids in Tulum and Chichen Itza, which is Mayan country on the Yucatan Peninsula. And I was with a girlfriend at the time, who later became my first wife. And it was just wonderful. That's the only thing I can tell you. I'm not a Trekkie. I'm not a Star Wars person. I don't go to those movies. I never really have. And when we got back, a friend of mine had asked me to come to a party. And I told him when I got back, we would see, because I thought I was going to be tired or what have you. But when I got back to New York, I wanted to show off my tan. I was in Mexico. And so, coming from 85, 88 degrees to 20 degrees, I wanted to gloat a little bit. So I went to the party. I stayed for about 90 minutes. Nothing was consumed, no adult beverages. I think I had a plate of potato salad. And I left. I got on the subway at Times Square, and I went home. I wake up in the middle of the night. I don't even remember what for. I don't remember if I had to go to the bathroom or anything. And I look at the edge of my bed, and there is a being who had chalk white skin, had a tight fitting jumpsuit, one piece that looked like aluminum foil, had a pear shaped head with I called him at that time kind of black Ray-Ban eyes, and the individual stared at me. I stared at him. I felt it was a him, and my heart felt like it was going to come through my chest. So I did what any other red-blooded American or any other red-blooded man would do. I pulled the cover up over my head and hoped it would go away.
And when I thought you would have said screamed or shot him with the pistol under your pillow like any other paranoid American.
No, let me tell you, I that was terror for me. And when I pulled the cover up over my head, I heard this whoosh, whoosh, this whooshing sound, and it felt like I was outside. It felt like I was in the warmth of my bedroom, and the temperature changed that drastically. And I pulled down the covers, and it was quiet. No one was there. And it was just eerily quiet. And so, needless to say, I went to a psychiatrist because I was fearing for my sanity. And this happened for 6 to 8 months, every new and full moon. I knew that they would come like clockwork. And they would paralyze me. I'd be wide awake and I couldn't move. And they would show pictures to me in my head of what they wanted to talk about. Now, since then, I've had two other species. I shouldn't say species because they're people. It's two other races and that have visited. But it really changed my, it got me into this whole thing about the Bible, because I'm not a scientific mind. I'm not a, I don't care about propulsion systems and back engineering. And of course, I know those things exist. And I'm not so much concerned about how they fly in their craft and get from A to B. I'm more into the spiritual aspects of these encounters. How do we negotiate, navigate with each other after having had an experience like the one I've had? I don't use the word abduction. I don't feel I was abducted. I let other people have had that experience, and they have to label it the way they will. But I have not felt that way. If anything, I've watched my life, my inner life, become more cultivated, and I've learned so much about what it means to be a human being.
Well, by seeing a comparison.
I'm sorry, Vince?
By seeing a comparison kind of thing, like you feel more like a human being because you've met creatures that aren't.
Well, yeah. I guess, how can I put it? Like I said, I mean, maybe we're all from someplace else. I tend to think we are, but I just know that no harm has come to me since my encounters. And I've learned, not magically, like I said, I've gone to therapy, I've been to workshop. I mean, I've had to evolve, you know, but I've got that impetus. And I've just lived my life from a more genuine, authentic place, a place more of love, if you will, a place more of risking being vulnerable. I'm much more forgiving than I was. I just feel that my life has changed for the better. But I also keep in mind that I'm not one of these people who think that all these intelligences want to hold our hand and sing kumbaya. Just as they're more evolved and lesser evolved humans, they're more evolved and less evolved off-world intelligences. But I just, like someone may say, well, they're all demons, or they're all fallen angels, or I've met them. And I just try to say, okay, that's your experience. I'm not here to take that from you. I'm just saying that one of the things that we do on this planet is we're quick to judge, and we're quick to paint everyone with the same brush, as it were. And I just really try not to do that.
And so what's your actual perspective on this? I mean, have you gotten any conclusions based upon this in terms of general alien activity? Like, what's their relationship to the human race? Do you have any idea?
Well, just from my own research and from, you know, my own visits, we are star people in the sense of everything we were taught is probably wrong about our origins. I do know that the beings that I have interacted with, and some of them look quite human, the first message that they've said to me is one of the biggest obstacles for them interacting with us is that we are very fearful people. We are very warlike people. And so in order for us to be able to become part of this, I guess, galactic brother and sisterhood, if you will, is to find another way to deal with our problems, another way to deal with our fear. We fight too much is the simple answer. And they're not telling us anything that Dr. King didn't say, or Jesus, or Muhammad, or Mother Teresa. This is not a profound conversation we're talking about. They're saying that your spirituality has not caught up with your technology. It's like putting a loaded gun in the hands of a child. And if you don't watch it, you're going to destroy yourselves and this planet.
So they're basically telling you something that the ordinary person would respond with, well, duh.
Yes. But even though we respond with, well, duh, we still can't seem to heed the message, can we?
That's because we're just so dumb.
Yeah.
To a degree, I don't know about how you feel about it, but I found having a humility for what you don't know is probably one of the most important strata of my life, is because I realize that I don't know everything, and the more I listen, the more I learn. And the more confused I get, actually, because I realize even more further and further along the path that you really don't know nothing. And the things that you think that you do know, they change periodically and sometimes massively and rapidly, and your entire life kind of is sort of like it's kind of like Lego. It stitches itself piece by piece by piece, and yet you can still take it apart and create something entirely different and unique.
I agree with you. It's the beginning of wisdom. And to realize the more you don't know, the wiser one can become, but we're just a long way from that now. But I do see signs of hope, and I believe that people can change, and I see signs of hope. But you know, it's either you're going to be part of the solution or part of the problem.
Could you tell us from your perspective, what's the mentality of somebody who's part of the problem versus the mentality of somebody who's part of the solution?
I think that part of the difference is, in my opinion, is choosing love over fear. And we get to make that choice every day. And it's not the absence of fear, which is courage. It's being able to move beyond the fear. And that's very, 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 very different. There's a wonderful line in Philip Corso's book, The Day After Roswell. And he's talking to one of the little entities, and one of the EBs, the extraterrestrial biological entities, or whatever name we give them from time to time. And he says to this being, what do you want? What are you bringing us? What are you offering us? And the star visitor says, a new world, if you can take it. I love that answer.
That sounds very similar to what a woman of the public asked, what was it, Benjamin Franklin. So what do we have, sir? Do we have a democracy or a republic? Franklin replied with, a republic, ma'am, if you can keep it.
There you go. And so I love that. I love that. If we can take it. And, you know, the way life goes, at least in my opinion, is that we can go kicking and screaming, or we can kind of let go and try to go with the flow. But either way, life happens, whether we go with it or not.
Yeah, it's very similar to that bumper sticker that starts with a four-letter word that rhymes with hit happens. And it seems that this is kind of like almost like it becomes a philosophy of life for some people that, oh, random stuff happens, etc. But I've kind of started to graft a little bit off that and started to believe more in synchronicity, meaningful coincidence, and things that actually really truly matter, that even though they've appeared to happen at random.
Yes, I mean, this is what we're talking about. And this is what quantum physics tells us. There are multiple realities, there are multiple possibilities, but what we focus on, we create. And so if we want to focus on lack and scarcity and war and, you know, your Tea Party and I'm Democrat or you're Black, if we want to focus on that, those divisions, we create more of it. But if we want to focus on the world that we want to create, well, we have the capabilities to do that. as well.
Well, I'd probably take myself as an example there. My perspective on the world kind of was at the time before I started the show and started making YouTube videos and things like that, that everything's totally screwed. I was in like a fetal position, sort of scared for my future and for the future of my country and my countrymen, right? Just basically wanted to say that I came out swinging and started doing what I thought was right. And along the way, I've had infinite support from people all around me. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, and we are sponsored by the High Tea Cafe, and there's also a number of books there on the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com. The crowdfunding Revolution is one of them, and The Range of Illusion by B. Holmes. We'll be right back with the Reverend Carter.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street, and there's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest, I don't want you to ride, I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being, God damn it, my life has value.
This is your new world order. The intent evil. Stack bodies, stack fear. Steal power from the people. It's the orchestra of war. Apocalyptic prequel. Halliburton, stay murky. Skull and bones, keep it legal.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. The show that's so gosh dang fabulous that you just can't get enough of it. You do realise the world's crazy, ladies and gentlemen, and you know why that is, you know why that seems, don't you? Yes, that's right. Psychopaths. Right? The psychopath mentality has been talked about for umpteen generations, dating back thousands of years. This mentality has persisted within the human race to claim to have the answer for everybody, to command everybody to worship me. And serve me as though I'm a god. And also backstab everybody that has ever helped you as soon as they've worn out their usefulness, having no loyalty, no trustworthiness, naught but scumbaggery. That's the psychopath, ladies and gentlemen. The American Medical Journal states that these people are very, very charming when you first meet them. One might even say enchanting. They ply you with compliments and tell you about all these amazing deeds that they've achieved. And it turns out that there's nothing there at all, and they're just trying to con you by showing you a reflection of what you love most. They use the very best of you against yourself. These psychopaths, again, going from the American Medical Journal, this is an article published, I think, in 2002, says that the places that these people are likely to find employment and find success in their employment are business, entertainment, politics, law, medicine, and of course, religion. So is it any wonder, ladies and gentlemen, when you turn around and you think to yourself, we live in a really insane world. Didn't you ever realize that it's because insane psychopathic scum are in the power centers of it? Maybe that's just a little something for you to think about, because I can guarantee you from that description I gave you of how a psychopath acts, you're like, when I first heard it, I was like, damn, it's like every employer I've ever had. My Reverend Michael J.S. Carter,
welcome back to the show. Sorry for that little rant out there, but it's just something that's been bugging me. It's on my mind, and the fact that people don't understand this this mentality of why the world's so freaking crazy and why you got to laugh about it and X these psychopathic scum out of your life, I think it's a really important note to touch upon, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, what passes for sanity in our world, especially, but not limited to our world leaders, one has to really, it gives one pause. And sometimes, you know, it's just very frustrating because you want to say, really? Really? But it's like the ego run amok. And then, you know, there are those who are still getting up every morning like you and me, trying to make sense out of it, trying to, trying to live a decent life. And, you know, that's not going to make the papers, but there are a lot of good people out there. And it's easy to forget that in a culture, especially here in the States, where we're all consumers and, you know, we're just taught that we're not good enough as we are, that, you know, you turn on the TV and Madison Avenue is great at that. If you want to get this car, if you want to get laid, you got to use this toothpaste. You got to get this car. You got to get these clothes. You're constantly being told that you're not good enough as you are. And that's what I was trying to touch on just a tad before, that you got to counteract that. And sometimes it's easier, it's more difficult to unlearn something than to learn something new. Because when you're bombarded with this all the time, you can begin to believe it. And so the question becomes, what other story can I tell myself beside the story that I'm being given?
Well, see, I've yet to unlearn that I'm not good enough as I am, and in fact feel a need to justify my existence by helping broader humanity in any way that I can. It turns out being a douchebag with a microphone is quite easy. Mm-hmm. So I publish people who talk about really important stuff. And I feel that this contributes to humanity in a really positive way by giving them information and levity, hence justifying my existence.
Let me tell you, Vincent, and I'm not saying this to placate you. People like you, other talk show hosts, not all, but you are doing a service to humanity because you're getting information out there. And if the information applied can be wisdom. So don't ever downplay it. Folk like you have helped me get my story out as well to counter this kind of this malaise that we're going through, at least here in Western culture, I believe. So this is big, what you're doing. This is not Mickey Mouse. So I thank you for giving me a platform, for giving me an opportunity.
Well, as Snoop Dogg once said, that comes from the heart, brother. Don't let it go to your head.
I love it.
And I feel that it's a symbiotic relationship. So I think when I first started out, Reverend, I felt like I needed information, but I wasn't willing to earn it the hard way. I wasn't willing to do the reading or keep up on all the news and do all that kind of stuff. So I just went to those people at protests that held megaphones or microphones or gave little speeches and things of that nature. And you realize that they actually are confined to 5 minutes speaking, like if they're lucky, in a public forum, confined to about 30 seconds if they're lucky on the mainstream media.
Yes.
And when I was listening to them, just talking to them as ordinary people, something dawned on me that every single researcher in this world who is, you know, pretty well known for doing what they're doing and knowing what they're talking about to the point of taking political action and actually making something of their lives devoted to this field of study, research, or healing other people, then you can give them virtually unlimited time to speak, and it would take them nearly their entire life to tell you these things that they have done in enough detail the way that they remember them. And it feels like I'm gaining not just an understanding, but I think as one of my listeners called a meta understanding of how the world works through all of these different eyes around the globe, looking at it from all these different angles. Personally, and also all the listeners that listen to the show, who listen to it regularly, if they consume every episode, you learn geometrically more from the format of this show than any other. I can pretty much state that categorically.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and there's always that fine line, isn't it? Because at least here, you know, we can confuse, and I'm talking about here in the States, you know, we confuse information with wisdom. And so granted, that wisdom, that information applied can be wisdom, but, you know, information for information's sake, you're just spinning your wheels. But we live in an information age. So the trick is, at least in my humble opinion, is not only to be well-informed, but to be able, if the information can be applied. I guess in biblical terms, we would say when the word becomes flesh, when I can take whatever it is intellectually, and in order for it not to be platitudes, I have to make it become flesh, which means I have to embody it. I have to live it.
Yeah.
And that's always the fine line.
Yeah. It's not enough to listen to Alex Jones.
Yeah. I mean, it's like whether you know, religion, spirituality, call it what you will, philosophy. It's one thing to be, you know, and very cerebral and go through the paralysis of analysis, but it's nothing is really real until you've experienced it. I have a lot of friends who fought in the Vietnam War. I happen to be sort of a Vietnam War scholar. That war always fascinated me. It ended a few months before I graduated, so I didn't get drafted. Because I graduated from high school in May of 75. But still, I can tell you dates, times, maybe even battles, but I wasn't there. And so it's like the Jimi Hendrix song, Are You Experienced? It's not real until you've experienced it.
And this is...
Not that I wanted to go into the jungles and kill people, But you know, it's theory until it's happened to you.
Yeah, I think this is probably something that has produced a phenomenon around particularly college and university graduates. They go straight out of high school from one institution into another, get themselves into monstrous debt, and then when they go out into the real world, they realize everything that they spent all those years and all that money on was worthless, and they have to start from scratch again. And
yeah, you're right. That you're touching on a good point. Does our education system really prepare us for the real world? I mean, I had to take geometry, and I never geomet, okay? I mean, I'm 57 years old. I haven't used geometry at all. And in some ways I'm being facetious, and in some ways I'm being very, very serious. How do we prepare people? Well, we see people now who've gone out, at least in the States here, and they got these degrees. And they're working at McDonald's. Not that, I mean, that's a job, but they're overeducated because there are no jobs for people in their field. Now, you know, you want to talk about being angry. I mean, I'm still paying for my seminary education and I'm using it. I graduated in the year 2000 from seminary and it was expensive. So what about people who, you know, paid all this money for school and then they can't find a job? It's frustrating.
Well, there is a solution to all of this, and that's the bringing out that old-fashioned, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, entrepreneurial, let's find a problem, let's make a solution and make it freaking happen for people, you know? That mentality, I think, has been kind of drummed out of people because it's always about, oh, the teacher has to tell me what to do. Oh, I need to go get a job, as opposed to, hold on a second, I can create things out of absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
In ways that nobody has any idea before I do it myself.
Yeah.
It's kind of like courage. You have no idea how much courage you have until after it's been tested.
Well, until you need it. Until you need it. And I don't know. I it's always a journey. But I wanted to bring it, I mean, to bring this back to, if you wanted to talk about the Bible a little bit and how I came to this hypothesis, I think it's stronger than that, that our monotheistic religions were inspired by extraterrestrial contact.
Go for your life, son. I hear there's a new series of Ancient Aliens coming up too.
Yeah. I've been fortunate enough to be on that show, and hopefully I'll get to be on it. It's getting ready to start its seventh season. I know I talked to people; they were like, how can they get any more material?" But they've managed to get a seventh season out of it, and I'm glad to hear it. I mean, certainly everything on there one doesn't necessarily have to agree with, but it gets people thinking, it gets people talking, and obviously there's a market for it, because again, they're going into their seventh season. So
could I'm I
kind of to be on that?
Could I offer an explanation? The reason why they've got enough material for a seventh and maybe even many more seasons is a true testament to the point of fact that the vast majority of the world's history ain't never been heard before on TV like that.
Yes. Yes. And see, Vinny, see, you just hit it on the head. And the thing is that so people like you and I and other people, not that we're above and at peace. I don't want our audience to, I'm not saying that we're not bad. No, but it's more, sometimes it's easier for certain people to adapt, because basically what we're saying is history as we know it has been a lie. For some people, they can't get out of bed in the morning once they hear this. For other people, we say, oh, really? Well, let me look into this. And other people say, well, I told you so. And so, yeah, and it's getting people talking. It's getting 48 to 52% of Americans believe in extraterrestrial life. Countries, and I'm not sure if Australia has, maybe they have, or maybe you're in New Zealand, but I know Britain has done it, France, Mexico, Ecuador, they've released most of their files to the public about extraterrestrial life. So the globe, I mean, people know about this. The Pope was just on, gave a mass the other day. Maybe you heard about it. And he was talking about that extraterrestrial, well, he's been saying, the Vatican's been saying this for several years now, but Pope Francis said, we would baptize extraterrestrials if they want that, extraterrestrial life will not change our theology. Now, the point is this, a lot of people are saying, Vincent, well, when are we going to have disclosure? When we're having disclosure now. It's just not, Obama's not coming out on the White House lawn here and saying, guess what, ladies and gentlemen, and maybe one day he may have to do that, whoever the next president is going to be.
So basically what we've got now is disclosure, except without the closure.
Well, we don't have it the way people picture. People think that they're going to get up one morning and whoever is the president is going to go to the Rose Garden or the White House lawn, and there'll be three or four mics set up, and he's going to make a big announcement. I mean, you go on YouTube, all of those photographs, and they're not all fake. And people believe that there is life on other planets. And so when you have the Pope say that, that's not just tongue in cheek. That's disclosure. That's disclosure. When you have people,
it's
like
talking
about this, the ancient aliens. That's disclosure.
Yeah, it's the gently approach. You know.
Yes. And you know what? People are going to miss the boat. I mean, I still talk to people, or when I'm on Facebook or whatever, and they're still talking about, well, here's the link that could prove to people that this is a part of a craft, or this is the link that shows this. And people are way past that now. Nobody's worried about, are you going to prove that there's a craft? People believe that. So for those people in the community, UFO community, who are still looking for a smoking gun, we've turned the page.
Well, you talk about people missing the boat, and it just... What was it that that happened? I think it was when Columbus came to the Bahamas. The people on the shore, they couldn't see the ships. Like,
yes.
They literally didn't have the ability to see something they did not understand at all.
Exactly.
The shaman, on the other hand, they could see the ships.
Yes.
And after preparing everybody else, gently, gradually, the village people could see the ships too, and then they came ashore. And then they came ashore and slaughtered them. So it wasn't really that all good. But hey, that's exploration, baby.
No, that's it. But and that's why it's so frustrating. Because I hear your frustration. I'm frustrated too with my fellow human beings that we're acting so crazy and we're killing each other and we're acting like you know buttholes. But that's the human evolution is slow. And when I started writing this book, I had to ask myself, are you taking faith away from people? But I just had to call it as I saw it. And it gave me a new perspective on who and what a God is. It made me read the Bible in a different way. I still think it's a wonderful book. There's pearls of wisdom in there, but there are also some things that we want to examine and say, do we really want to believe this? Do we really want to live our lives this way? Just because someone wrote something 5,000 years ago doesn't mean it's true today.
You're right, and there's a number of points that you've been raising here. I kind of want to elaborate on if you'll let me. In terms of the whole missing the boat thing, there's a joke. There's a dude in New Orleans, and the water's rising. He's up. He's on top of his roof, and the water's all around him. And a little rowboat comes along, and guy on the rowboat says, "Hey, mate, jump in the boat. We'll take you to safety." Guy goes, "No. God will save me." The guy goes, "All right." He rows on. Water rises even more. He's now up to his knees in it, and a powerboat comes along, and the Coast Guard guy goes, "Oi! Jump in the boat. We'll take you to safety." Guy goes, "No. God will save me." So the guy goes, "All right." Power boat's off down the street. And then water rises a bit more and he's up to his neck. And a Coast Guard chopper turns up, lowers a basket down and says, "Jump in the basket. We'll take you to safety." Guy goes, "No. God will save me." And then he drowns. And he goes to the pearly gates. God's there, like with his arms folded, stepping his foot on the ground, kind of annoyed. Like, the guy goes, "God, why didn't you save me?" God looks at him and says, "Bro, I sent you a rowboat, a powerboat, and a helicopter. What did you expect?"
Yeah, and the boat, and you've missed the boat, and so, you know, It's about living life, and it's difficult, but living it a little less fearfully, being open to new ideas, even ideas you don't agree with. I don't know whether it was Socrates or Plato or someone a little more contemporary that said that the mark of a mature mind is being able to hold two conflicting ideas in tension. You know, you don't have to agree with it, but you can still be able to unpack them, if you will. And I think we're losing that more and more. And I'm just talking about in here in the States. I don't know. I don't want to, you know, paint everybody with a broad brush. But again, I do. Listen, the Japanese have made killing whales illegal. France has outlawed fracking. These are changes of consciousness. This is major. We don't hear about it, and we're overwhelmed with all the negative news. But you know, there's a consciousness changing, and that's what gives me hope.
Well, and we were talking about hope, and earlier before you were talking about frustration with your fellow man, and I feel this too. And again, to reiterate, as you also said earlier, not to say that we're any better. You know, we're still humans. We're still flawed as people, but it doesn't mean that we can't notice this, symptoms and patterns. And when you're talking about it being frustrating around people, I was kind of contemplating, what is the source of frustration? Like, why is it that people get frustrated? And I think it's restraint, right? You've got a great idea. You can implement it right away if only people would get out of your way. That, or the second point of frustration is you've got an idea and you've got a great way of doing it, but you won't get out of your own way.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
You and I, we're independent, we're doing our own thing in our own way, so we've gotten out of our own way. Now we just need everybody else to get out of it too.
Well, see, now I'm going to take it a step further. I concur with what you just said. I also feel, though, at least for me, I'm speaking for Michael, the ego is a very subtle thing, and a lot of it can be about control. If you only do it my way, you'll get it right. And you know, to be a leader, well, not even to be a leader, you can only go as fast as your slowest person. And sometimes I feel that at least my frustration is that I can get very goal-oriented, I can get very task-oriented, but sometimes it's that ego saying, I got the answer, they don't. Come on, don't you get it? Why don't you just do it the way I... And so I don't want to do that. But also, Joseph Campbell said it so beautifully, that when you're on a journey and your goal looks like it's getting further and further away, if you're lucky, you'll realize that the journey is the goal. And so then the question becomes, what kind... It's not so much that I get to there, because maybe there's no there, but what it means is, what kind of person do I become while I'm on the journey? That's more important than the goal. But what kind of person do I become? And when I start thinking about that, and really, as you quoted Snoop, it comes from the heart, don't go to the head. It keeps me from the hubris of, oh, come on, man. Can't you see that? Don't you see what I'm saying is right? You don't get this? Because sometimes you wind up becoming the problem, because in the subtle way that the ego does, you can get righteous. One can get righteous. So it's always something to be on the lookout for. This is what the Buddhists talk about. The ego is a very subtle character, if you will. And the frustration sometimes can be about, I just want to hurry up and get there, but I need to not forget that the journey is more important than the goal.
You know, I think that whole self-analysis thing is incredibly important, because nobody knows you better than you know yourself. And if you stop questioning yourself, there's no telling what kind of unruly monster you might turn yourself into. The Vinnie Eastwood Show is what you're listening to, ladies and gentlemen. Our sponsors are the Crowdfunding Revolution book by Kevin Lawton, The Range of Illusion by B. Holmes. Also, check us out on the affiliate stations, Ifinity FM, Rush FM and Dagsy FM networks. We also appear on UnitedWeStrike.com monthly radio marathon, and we're also sponsored by the High Tea Cafe in Newlyn in New Zealand there, and the Gourmet Soap Kitchen in Wagga Wagga. Also, if you're afraid of your electronic smart meters and all of this other stuff that's around us, all this electromagnetic radiation BS, get yourself a Blue Shield, yo. All right, you know how frequency works? The stronger the frequency, it cancels out every other frequency. They all automatically go in tune to whatever frequency is strongest. This is the same as socially as it is electronically. Ladies and gentlemen, he who has the highest frequency wins. And this puppy pumps out the natural, really strong, powerful frequency that the Earth gives out on an amplified spectrum. So it cancels out all the other ambient radiation from your electronic devices that you're normally bathed in every day. And even if you don't feel the effects, studies have proven that your cells do. For electrosensitive and non-electrosensitive people who don't even feel anything going on, your cells and your sperm and everything else experiences the same amount of degradation. So get yourself a Blue Shield at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
We'll be right back after the break with the Reverend Michael Carr. Ladies and gentlemen, on the Vinnie Eastwood Show with the Reverend Michael Carter. Now, as a lot of research has kind of come to me about occult researchers in particular, is that when you're having a conversation with them, they have these thoughts about things that you've said, and then they take the conversation back to elaborate on one of them, and then the conversation progresses forward, and then it goes back again and forward. In so doing, you cover ground, and then you consolidate it, and then it becomes a rigid core of knowledge through almost repetition and reverting to its natural form in the conversational sense of the word, or at least this is how I've found my conversations with, say, Frader X and James Robert Wright, who are profound Freemason scholars. So, yeah, I feel very similar with you. Now, you made a point on the previous segment about evolution being slow, and again, relating back to the frustration, but evolution can be sped up, all right? Wouldn't you say that fire... or industrial agriculture sped up evolution, or
I'm with you, but I'm talking on a spiritual level.
Oh yeah,
But I agree with you, because when I had my contacts, my evolution was speeded up. No doubt that the way I looked at life, the way I approached life, was accelerated after meeting these beings. No doubt in my mind. And it's not to say I don't have problems. It's not to say, you know, I don't have a lot to learn. But I quickly, and okay, someone's probably saying, in what way?
In a general kind of way.
Well, my belief in separation has diminished tremendously. I touched on it before. The belief that you and I are separate, whether it's race, whether you're on the other side of the planet. But I really got from my head to my heart that we really are all connected. And what I do to you, I've really done to me. And people go lifetimes, and maybe I have, without really getting that. I get this now on much more than an intellectual level. I can feel it. Now, maybe even without, I'm not saying that people have to have other world intelligences come to you to make this happen. Not saying that. A lot of people get this without this happening. But for me, when I started having these contacts, And I still sometimes it's almost like I can't believe myself. The way I handle situations differently, I'm much more forgiving. I'm much more sensitive to the needs of others. I'm much more connected to this planet. I'm much more connected to that you and I are really one. And it's not just kumbaya, la-di-da. It's you know, something nice platitude. I really get that now in ways that I never got before.
And now, and of course, the understanding can always be furthered.
Always. Oh, always. And every day that, you know, I get a chance to do that. But yes, Industrial Revolution. Yes, the technological age in which we live. But that's evolution in the sense of, you know, for the sake of evolution. And it's a good thing. But I'm talking about more what King was talking about, more than what the great avatars and saints were talking about, that our spirituality has not caught up with it. That's why we're in the position today.
There's a Japanese saying that you've got to keep your eye on the past and your hand on the future. Mm-hmm. Now, I think what that means today, or at least the way I interpret it, to the level of technology that we have today to spread truth, information, you can broadcast spirituality through radio waves, can't you? Many ministers have radio shows, TV shows, etc. And this thing seems to work out all for the better because you're spreading out more energy, right? And that's using the knowledge of the past along with the technology of our current abilities, right? And I think that's what evolution is really about, is about learning how to effectively use the things that are available to you at the time to kind of do God's work, if you will.
Yeah, see, I disagree. I think it's what the Buddha's saying. It's not so much about the past and the future, because you're creating your future by what we do now. The Buddha's say it's about living in the now.
Oh, I agree with that too.
That's where life is. And in the West, we're looking back, we're looking forward, but we're not in the now. Like right now, I'm with you now. I'm not thinking about what I'm going to do when we hang up in a half hour or whatever it is, or what I have to do tomorrow, because I'm talking about what's going on right now, because this moment won't happen again.
Well, that's a contradictory perspective that I hold simultaneously as my other one.
Gotcha. Yes. Well, there you go. You can hold both, because I'm with you. Yes. You can't listen. I can sit up here and say, oh, I'm so much in the now. But guess what, baby? I better be able to pay my rent at the end of the month. That's the future. So, yeah, you know, you're right. You gotta plan. But for me, and then you may be able to resonate with this. This is another story. We're doing a lot of parables today, and I love it. But this is a true story. There was a therapist I went to, and he was telling an audience about the Pope coming to America. And this is when he had a little bubble, the little Pope mobile. And this guy said, I got to see the Pope. He was a devout Catholic. And he said, this may never happen in my lifetime again. So when the Pope came, so he goes and he sets up his tripod. He's going to take a picture of the Pope. And, you know, he's back away from the street and he sees the crowds and the Pope is coming and waving and blessing. And he sets up his camera and, you know, he's so busy. He gets the picture of the Pope. But he realizes that he wasn't there, because he was so busy setting up and making sure he got the right angle and all these things that he really wasn't in the moment. It's like people who go on vacation and they come back and show you the pictures, and they're more excited when they're showing you the pictures than they were when they were there. And that's what life can be like. In a world where there's so much information, there's so much technology. I mean, I was doing it before you called me. And I tried to talk myself out of it. Mark, my publicist, had sent me a text. I had to talk to my wife about something. And I kept saying, I want to be centered. I want to do a good interview when Vinny calls, you know. And then I would sit down for 5 minutes. And then, oh, my goodness, I got to go get this off the stove. I got to get something to eat. And, you know, I had to really force myself. Benny's going to call me, and I need to be present. Because otherwise, I'd have missed the moment. Yes, I would have answered your questions and that kind of thing, but I still wouldn't have really been there. Because I'd have been thinking about, okay, I didn't finish this, and I got to get this off the stove, and I told my wife I'd call her back. And you know, and these are the moments that life is made up of. These are moments.
There's an old saying that it's the small things that drive you crazy, you know, like a doorknob not working properly or an untied shoelace or something like that.
Yeah.
But it's usually the little things that drive you over the edge.
I know. So I had to do that. And you know, I'm listening to you, and we've been on the phone. We've been talking for about 90 minutes or so. And you know, you're a philosopher. You're a philosopher. And when I, you know, I Skyped you the other day, and I wrote something, a voice crying in the wilderness. And that's what you are. You're like a John the Baptist, and you get frustrated because you're saying, look, gang, I'm trying to get you. This is not Mickey Mouse. This is your life. And I'm bringing this information to you, and I'm bringing speakers on, and I'm trying to give you this, and I'm getting frustrated. But you know what? You love these people, Vinny, because you don't get upset with things you don't care about. Yeah. And that's the frustration. There's a love there. Now, you may not use that word. That's what I'm using. But things you don't care about, they don't bug you because you don't care. But you care about what you're doing. You care about the people that listen to this show. You care about the messages that you're trying to get out.
Otherwise, I wouldn't be trying to help.
Exactly.
And I always find about these. Have you seen the New Age philosophy movement? It's kind of like "Do as thou wilt." Is more like an Aleister Crowley occult offshoot. It's very scary that some of these people. However, it's like a number of them that I've spoken to have the exact opposite lifestyle to the one that they preach and purport to think. Like, for example, they say there is no good. There is no evil, so it doesn't matter what any of us do. And then I ask them, so why do you make health products for a living that benefit people's lives and purge toxic chemicals that evil people put into their food from their body? If you think that there's no good or any evil and that you don't have to play any part.
Yeah.
The way we live our lives is more or less the opposite of what we think a lot of the time. I seek to form a congruence. I'm only 29, and I'm just kind of like gradually going up the ladder of, shall we say, closing off rabbit holes of what appear to me to be insignificant for investigation at this point. For example, learning to play the guitar. I don't really give a frack at the moment because I'm doing so much other stuff. Or learning French, you know. Yeah. It'd be nice and changing up and everything, but thing is, I'm doing so many different things, learning so many amazing things that changing direction entirely and devoting a decent portion of my life to it that would actually be a requirement doesn't seem to have its appeal, whereas I can achieve so much in so little time by doing what I'm doing now. It's kind of like prioritizing your life at the time.
And that's what you have to do, Vinny, because, you know, listen, 29 years from now, you'll be a very different person than you are now. And many
3 months
many,
from now, I will be.
No question. But definitely 29 years. And so the things that you're not doing now, you may make more room for. But, Vinny, I want to ask you something. Can I tell people where they can buy this book?
I'm surprised you haven't done it several times already. We still have half of this segment and one more segment to go after this. I'm sorry we got delayed in starting the broadcast.
Oh, no question. I just want to, can I say it?
This radio show is like a bathtub. Doesn't work very well without a plug.
Okay. I want to tell the listening audience that Alien Scriptures, Extraterrestrials in the Holy Bible, You can purchase it at Amazon.com. You can purchase, it's $9.89. You can pick up the Milk or Kindle version, which is $4.99. Or you can go to my website, which is MichaelJSCarter.com, and you can blog me, and you can also pick up the book there. So I commend it to you, and you can always, you know, write me and give me your opinion and tell me I'm crazy or maybe I'm not or whatever. But I want to get the word out there. Amazon.com, Alien Scriptures, Extraterrestrials, and the Holy Bible. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there you go.
I also wanted to talk about what was it? Subjectivity. You know how you're talking about unity, and how that's really important to realize that we're kind of all one, and to live in the now and that kind of thing. I hold that view, but also at the same time, I hold on to a value in the unique perspective of subjective analysis. How does this feel for me? Do you know what I'm saying? Like having your own take on situations is what makes you unique. And if you're not unique, then in a lot of ways you don't perform vital functions for the continuation of society. I think the way society has been structured by the psychopathic quote-unquote elite has been to, let's say, suppress that whole, you know what? I can make a difference in this world. I can help people in amazing ways. I can make history. That they're trying to suppress that personal, subjective contribution to the holistic journey that we're all going through. You know what I'm saying? Like if everybody's on the merry-go-round together, one person stepping one foot off the merry-go-round and pushing it just that little bit faster can make everybody fall off if it goes too much. You know, one person can make the difference, no matter how hard the ride's going already.
Well, I don't think that those two are definitely opposed to each other. There is, like I think I mentioned before, there is unity doesn't mean you give up your uniqueness. Unity means that no matter what happens, you realize that we are part of a whole. No one is so unique that what they do to other people, what's done, does not affect them. It's like you go out to the ocean and you put some ocean water in a glass, and then if that ocean water in the glass thought that it was different from the rest of the ocean because it was in the glass, that'd be absurd. So I'm not talking about giving up one's unique gifts. I'm just saying that maybe we are so unique, people think they're so unique that they forget that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. That's what I'm talking about. And as far as
what I'm talking about is that the whole does not exist without the sum of the parts.
Well, you know, we may be saying the same thing, mm-hmm. but I don't think that unity means that I have to give up who I am and my gifts, but they all go back to the whole. And in a culture that prides itself on individualism, I think it's easy to say, it's easy to forget that I am my brothers and sisters keeper.
Could I relate this? Let's say it's about a child comes into this world, you raise them as best you can, you send them out into the world and they can do whatever they want. And if they need help, they come back for it and you give it to them. Right.
Yeah.
That's the human race.
Well,
and our relationship with the gods and aliens and everything, isn't it?
Well, I think it is to a degree. I mean, it's different. You're more likely, one is more likely to help their daughter or their son than a stranger. What I'm saying is that, and you can't do anything you want. You are responsible to other people. That's the difference between the Eurocentric thought of Descartes, I think, therefore I am, which is very individualistic because there's no I in team, whereas in many Aboriginal cultures, it's we are. I am because we are, and we are because I am. Very different visions of what life is like.
I believe it's a kind of like, I like to give people their due credit. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think Chris Fowley's a cannabis activist in New Zealand. But I don't know what your views on cannabis are, but I think it should be legalized to prevent most people from smoking it, especially kids, to that matter. And I realized after interviewing him, I think this was actually the first full-length interview I'd ever done with him, and I'd known him for like five, six years. He'd actually sacrificed the bulk of his life. Incredibly smart dude. And he spends all his time financing, working, and supporting the cannabis movement. And he's been doing so for decades, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Given up the best years of his life. And I feel that he's greatly underappreciated and deserves profound thanks and acknowledgement for his sacrifices. And I think this applies to all of us to a large degree, is that the part of the reason, I think, that we really try hard to do something good is because we need to be acknowledged and appreciated for it, not to do it in the first place, but to continue doing it. I think without encouragement, people fall off that bandwagon of doing the right thing for people and become bitter, egotistical, and say, I'm going to take care of me and my family, if the rest of you. And I've seen it happen to people.
I agree. I agree with you. People want to be acknowledged. People, they want to know that they're not invisible, that I have significance, that I matter. Now,
they need love.
Yes, in a word, yes. And the only trick to that is that when one matures and gets to realize that I also have to be able to accept myself, I also have to be able to appreciate myself, I also have to be able to love myself before someone will really love me. Because the greatest love of all is self-love. And if you're waiting to be affirmed by someone else, you could be waiting a very long time. And so it's that fine line between loving oneself. Because loving oneself means, yes, putting good food in your body, wearing clothes, I mean, taking care of yourself. But it also means having healthy boundaries, that I'm not going to let someone do this to me, whether it's in a erotic relationship or an intimate relationship or a casual relationship. You know, loving yourself is being able to say no. Loving yourself is having good boundaries. Robert Frost says, good fences make good neighbors. So it's also because if you're waiting for someone else to affirm you, you may be waiting the rest of your life. It's like the disclosure piece on a more abstract level. If I'm waiting for Obama, or if I'm waiting for my government to tell me that what I've been through is real, I may never get affirmed, but I know what I experienced.
I have the perfect analogy. I walked into the kitchen. I saw it was filthy. I totally cleaned that stuff up, man. And the whole kitchen was spotless. And I thought, and I looked at the spotless kitchen that I made and I thought, that's awesome. That looks really nice. I feel great. And then my wife walks in and she says, wow, the kitchen's really clean. And I go, yep. I didn't need her to say, wow, the kitchen's really clean. I knew it was, but it still felt good.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great analogy. We need both. But we need to be able to affirm ourselves. I think that's the greatest love, because if you don't, you may go a long time before someone says, you know what, Vinny, you did a real good job. And if you're waiting for that and waiting for that, and then you don't get it, and then you might start saying, well, I'm not good enough, they didn't affirm me. It's the logic of absurdity.
And it gets even worse the more compliments that you get for the lesser achievements, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's always good to have other people affirm you, but it's always good to affirm yourself.
Yeah. Otherwise, what was it? Somebody, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're coming to break now. Remember to check out the homepage, thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. Check out the people who've been sponsoring the show of late. And also remember the primary source of income for this show and has been funding me for the last 4 years that I have been on air is you, the listeners, giving me gifts through the PayPal and the Kiwi Bank account. This is largely listener-supported broadcasting. I mean, we have advertisers here and there or whatever, but they're basically just listeners themselves who want to donate something to the show too. So it cannot survive without you, ladies and gentlemen. Big media companies and everything like that, they need big corporations to be sponsoring them. This is real media, and it needs real support from real people just like you. So please go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and sign up to give a regular automatic payment either through the PayPal or bank account details that are available there. We'll be right back with the Reverend Michael Carr.
I never meant to lie. How many special people change? How many lives are living strange? Where were you when we were getting high? Slowly walking down the hall, faster than a cannonball. Where were you when we were getting high? Someday you will find me caught beneath the landslide. In a champagne supernova in the sky. Someday you will find me caught beneath the landslide. In a champagne supernova. A champagne supernova in the sky.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's now the final segment with Michael Carter. Speaking about being a philosopher. And a philosopher means somebody with a love for knowledge. I say that's about right. It's kind of like a thirst for knowledge. And I drink now from a cool mountain ice melt stream, pure as the driven snow. Michael Carter, welcome back.
Thank you, brother. It's good to be back. This has been great.
It has been. Now, we need to plug the hell out of your book, and we're going to spend this 25 minutes doing so, ladies and gentlemen. So we're going to impart some knowledge to you, and we're also going to show you the places where you can get the book, and of course the links and the blog post for this show. If you search Reverend Michael Carter on the VinnyEastwoodShow.com little search tab in the top right hand corner, you should be able to come up with this, as well as the link to the Amazon book where you can buy it. So, Michael, if you wouldn't mind, tell us a little bit about the name of the book, what it's about, and so forth.
Okay. The book is called Alien Scriptures, Extraterrestrials in the Holy Bible. Now, I did add a couple chapters. I added a chapter on Islam because I believe that the three monotheistic religions are basically telling the story of extraterrestrial contact. And, of course, the same many of the characters in the Torah, the Hebrew Torah, the New Testament, are also in the Quran. The book, you know, and I also added my own lessons learned, if you will, or as I was saying to you, Brother Eastwood, you know, the wisdom gleaned from these contacts. And I went through the Bible, and I will go over you know, with the time allotted as quickly as I can, in case there's questions or whatever. And I believe that the Hebrew religion is originated with extraterrestrials. Why? Because there's no Hebrew religion until after the Exodus. Because the Hebrews are in, after they cross through the Red Sea, the ocean split, which I believe the sea splits, which I believe was caused by this craft. They're following the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night. And basically what they're saying is this craft looked like a cloud, or it emitted a cloud. Modern day UFO sightings do the same thing. And at night, it glowed like fire. So it's the pillar of fire by night. They follow it. Well, it says they followed it for 40 years. But it's in the air. That means it's intelligently guided. And they stop at night. They camp underneath of it. It's supposed to be manna or food that was thrown down from the craft to the Hebrew people. This is a UFO. At least it's a UFO. It's an unidentified flying object. So you can't, Christianity comes out of Judaism. And so here we have the beginning of the Hebrew religion. They get the commandments. There were 613 of them in the beginning. They narrowed it down to 10. Or as I heard one comedian say, we narrowed it down to 10, but adultery's still in. However you want to look at it, they narrow it down to 10. But people have to remember that these laws were only meant for the Jewish people. They weren't meant for everybody else. You were not supposed to kill. It says thou shalt not kill. In the Hebrew, it means thou shalt not murder. That's the correct translation, the Hebrew translation. No, you don't go sleep with your neighbor's wife while he's on a business trip. You don't kill. You don't covet your neighbor's things. But this was only for the Hebrew people. It was not for the goyim. It was not for the uncircumcised ones. It was not for the dirty Gentiles. Why? Because they go into the promised land where there's men, women, and children, and they take the land and they kill them. What happened to the Ten Commandments? So that's one piece of the journey, Vincent. It also made me think about what kind of God will kill all the firstborn Egyptian babies. To me, I interpret this person as the commander of a spaceship, because I could not worship a God that would kill babies. Now, so we know about Ezekiel. We know about Ezekiel chapter 1. He's on the river Chebar. He describes the craft that he sees. This is a craft. And he says he's taken up into the air. So for those of you who brought your Bibles, read the first chapter of the first two chapters, three chapters of the book of Ezekiel. I want to jump now to there are other passages in the Bible that talk about I interpret as contacts, but I want to move on with the time allotted. The book goes into it. Let's go to the birth of Jesus. We know that stars do not fly across the heavens and stop and shine lights down on mangers. We know that. We know that doesn't happen. If that happened, the whole gravitational pull of the earth. You want to talk about tsunamis. You want to talk about earthquakes. If a star did that, this is just a little bit of what you would experience. But this craft, which I think it's a craft, shows the wise men where Jesus is, shines a light down on it, and here we have the beginnings of Christianity. Now, Jesus was not Christian. He was Jewish. But he says, my kingdom is not of this world. He says that. And for me, if your daddy is an E.T. and your mother's human, that means you're not fully human. You're not fully human. And we're just going to take the clues that we see in the Bible. Now, whenever the angel appears, one thing, when angels appear, women always get pregnant. I always found that interesting, that this God was very concerned with sexuality. You were supposed to not intermarry. But wherever an angel comes up, in the book of Judges, chapter 13, when Samson is born, his mother is barren, as was Abraham's wife, Sarah. And the angel appears. That means when barren, that they were past the point of menopause. They were elderly women. But yet, they wound up pregnant. An angel appears. Gabriel tells Zechariah that his wife is barren, but will conceive in the Gospel of Luke. His wife is named Elizabeth. Elizabeth is the mother of John the Baptist, who's a cousin of Jesus. I just mentioned Genesis chapters 11 and 23, when Abraham's wife Sarah is barren, and she gives birth. And of course, there's the birth of Jesus. There's always these extraordinary men who are born from these unions. And so Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world. When he's before Pilate, and Pilate in the book of John says, you don't answer me at his trial. He says, don't you know I have the power to crucify you? And what does Jesus say? His reply is, you would have no power over me unless it was given to you from above. If I wanted to, I could pray to my Father, and he would send 12 legions of angels. Any power that you have over me is given to you from above. And we look at the word angel, which is from the Greek angelos, which means messenger. It doesn't mean that these beings had wings, even though I've had people argue with me that they've seen angels with wings. I'm sure you have. I'm not going to say that that's not true. That's your experience. But I believe our ancestors showed wings on these beings because they were trying to say that they could fly. Mm. And so, I mean, in Abraham, he feeds them. He calls them the Lord. And so he feeds them, and they eat. They're not wispy, etheric little beings with wings. They eat their flesh and blood. He feeds them. And so...
Can I quickly make a mention? Please. You've got to turn your speakers down. There was a little bit of feedback, or at least there was. It's gone now. It reminded me of the ancient Greek stories about all of the quote-unquote gods that came down from Olympus, took the forms of other animals and mated with humans left, right, and center. There are all these demigods and stuff walking around, you know? That's kind of what we're talking about here as well, isn't it?
Yes, because they could shapeshift. We've heard that from Native Americans. But you see where I'm going with this. Now, the other thing is, for instance, in Isaiah chapter 40, verse 22, it reads, it is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers. How did somebody 5,000 years ago know that the earth was a sphere or a circle and that its inhabitants are like grasshoppers? You only can get that perspective if you are above the earth. I was taught that the earth was flat until Columbus discovered that it wasn't. So again, these are the things that had me asking questions. In the book of Job, in the book of Amos, chapter 5, verse 8, who made the Pleiades and Orion? Who turns deep darkness into dawn? I mean, what did they know? How did they know 5,000 years ago about the Pleiades? Here we have Job, chapter 9. Who made the bear and Orion? Who made the Pleiades and the chambers of the south wind? I mean, they're talking about constellations, some of them that we didn't discover until modern times, 18th, 19th, 20th century, and they're talking about them 5,000 years ago. So this is the premise of my book.
Well, you're talking about a more or less, would you say Jesus is an alien?
I would say that he is a hybrid, that his mother was human, that his daddy wasn't, and that at least one could say, in the short way, yes, I'm just trying to be diplomatic here, we could say that he was from an advanced civilization.
And he made good beer, I hear, because he brews. That's the sound of a bass drum and a thimble and a cymbal falling off a cliff. Okay, now, there was the other element here about what I think God is actually in the modern context. You talking about philosophy and what have you, the knowledge that has been lost, particularly when the Romans burned the Library of Alexandria, of course, secreting away most of the best kept secrets of the world's true history for themselves.
It was the Greeks.
Okay. And locked away in the Vatican. For goodness knows how long. Right.
Well, yeah, there are a lot of... I wish I could go through the Vatican's library, yes.
I bet you that you're one of goodness knows how many biblical scholars who would just die with joy in order to get into the Vatican library. You know, you know what I'm saying?
Yes. Yes.
I don't know. What is it about? Knowledge is power, hide it well. And the Vatican does hide it well, and they're still in power.
They're in power. They're in power, but I think they're a little bit on the retreat. And I'll tell you why. They got this new Pope, Francis. He's pretty progressive. At least he talks a good game. But he also knows that, and the Vatican also knows, because they've been doing this for the last 6-10 years, they've also been talking about the possibility of extraterrestrial life. Now, what they do is they've gone from talking about the possibility of it to making statements like they did the other day about we could baptize extraterrestrials. But even then, Monsignor Baladucci, the late Monsignor Baladucci, came out and said that, of course, there's extraterrestrial life. Now, they couldn't say that unless they, he as a Monsignor, couldn't say that unless he was given permission to. There's a whole interview in, with him in Whitley Strieber's book, Confirmation. But they'd want to be on the right side of history. And so, because they can see the writing on the wall, that sooner or later, the gig is up, and that the religions of the world, at least Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, the three monotheistic religions, they're going to have to do some shuffling around when this happens. And it is happening now. So what they're doing is they're saying, you didn't tell me, I told you. So they've come out and said, basically, that yes, there's probably life on other planets. So in order to stay relevant, they're going to have to talk a different game. This Pope is talking a different game. He's saying the right words. He's hitting the right notes. But that's because he has to. That's because they have to. Because in our lifetimes, not unless I run out here and get hit by a car or you something happens, we're going to see in our lifetime probably the full disclosure of extraterrestrial life.
Drips and drabs to slowly prepare the population so that when the full disclosure comes, it, most people just shrug it off and a few people will freak out, but then they'll be ostracized and or told to calm the frack down. And in so doing, all the humanity will just go, oh, wow, there's aliens that are out there and we're just humans. Now we need a one world religion and a one world government. You know, that's my concern about how this might be played, rather than be used for the knowledge and the technology and maybe advancements and consciousness, which a lot of this information going public could connote. I fear its misuse by those currently in power, so that they can, as they always do, get more power.
I agree with you. But see, this is the thing about prophecies, any prophecies. And this is what my brothers and sisters who are deeply involved in interpretation of Bible prophecy, they don't realize that these are probabilities. They don't have to be. My concerns are as deep as yours, that it depends on what star people that they're talking about. It depends on the star people that we're working with. Because we are working with star nations, and all of them aren't the same. And so if they're more regressive, yes, we can have the wool pulled over our eyes. They can use our religions to take advantage of us. I think that's a concern. But I also think that things don't have to happen if people wake up, because quantum physics tells us that there are many probabilities. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle talks about probabilities. And if people wake up, the prophecies don't have to come through and come true. And so in some ways, in this case, the prophecies that don't come true are the good ones, because we don't want a one world government. We don't want to be microchipped, and we don't want. But it is, you're right. We have the surveillance. I mean, I live in a surveillance state. We have we have this militaristic war on terrorism, which means my 8-year-old daughter will never live in a country, I don't want to say never, that's not at war, because we're at war with an ideal. There's no such thing as a war on terrorism, because you can't have a war against an ideal. There's no enemy there. But it can look grim. But shows like yours, but people coming out talking about these things, you know, there doesn't have to be their probabilities. And quantum physics tells us that what we focus on, we create. So you want to focus on fear, you want to focus on, and I'm not saying being an ostrich, but I'm saying, like Gandhi said, you want peace, then be peace. You want love, then be love. You want to create a world other than what we have, then be part of the process.
I want to tell all those people who send messages to me and other talk radio show hosts telling us what to do and how to do it and what have you. And my answer is, dude, what's stopping you from doing it? I'm doing my own thing. I don't seem to be making too bad of a mess of it. Perhaps you could start doing your own thing instead of expecting everybody else to live your dream so that you can live vicariously through us. Yes. That's a bad move, brother.
Yeah, it is, brother.
Okay, and speaking of which, you got so many things on the go. You've heard the analogy: there's so many pots on the boil at the same time.
Yes.
All right. When you're in a complicated situation and you're trying to be independent and whatever, you do have a lot of pots on the boil, and it's good having like a wife and good friends and stuff like that, because occasionally one of them will point out when one of those pots is starting to burn.
Yes.
You need to turn the heat down a little bit, you know. And the analogy I'm talking about with this awakening process, as we're talking about on many facets, many levels, it's a multifaceted awakening, okay? It's kind of like a psychological tortoise and the hare. The bad guys are kind of like the tortoise. They've been moving very slowly and gradually into position towards that finish line. And the bulk of humanity is the hare. We've gone asleep under the tree and relaxed and confident that we can win any race we want. And suddenly we've woken up a little late and we're rushing towards the finish line before the tortoise gets there. You know, like that's kind of what we're at. And when it comes to voluntarism and making your own contributions to the world, not like, oh, I've made a difference in the world, I'm great, look at me, Vinnie Eastwood, blah, blah, blah. Whoever the hell you are, I don't really, it doesn't seem to matter. What matters is if you live your life with the purpose of helping others, you always wind up helping others a hell of a lot more than you could ever possibly realize. And the reverberations of your effects of helping others permeate throughout eternity. Okay? That's what history is. It's living in the now. So all of history is just one moment that's been stretched out and kept going. It's a continuous moment. It's even right now here in this very room. In a way, we get to share a moment with everybody who has ever lived or whoever will. And that's a pretty encouraging thought, don't you think? Because if we're going to be defending humanity from all of these different ways in which we're under attack, I've adopted what's called the tactic of the cactus. For every way in which you're being attacked, a cactus kind of has a spine jutting out in every single direction. So it doesn't matter where it gets attacked from, it'll be giving that little attacker a prick to remind them, leave me alone. Two types of people in the world, those who want to be left alone and those who won't leave you alone. And when it comes to conspiracy and scumbaggery and a holistic attack upon our psychology, our health and well-being, and spirituality, I can assure you, ladies and gentlemen, that somewhere in the world, there is one person, usually only one, for whom that exact particular little attack is something that they fully understand and are utterly capable of resisting. And all those little spines, individually, without even awareness of each other, jutting out in every single direction, is collectively protecting humanity even as we speak.
Yes. And remember, it's the people we become on the journey, not the journey itself.
Yeah. The Reverend Michael Carter, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for this conversation. I've quite enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. Let's do it again.
Now, quickly rattle off again, just as a reminder, before we cap off the broadcast, what the name of your book is and whereabouts they can search for it.
Okay, again, and thank you again, Vinny. It is Alien Scriptures, Extraterrestrials in the Holy Bible. You can get it at Amazon. It's $9.89, I think. At least it's here in the States. It may be cheaper. $9.89 for the paperback, $4.99 on Nook or Kindle. You can also go to my website, which is Michael J.S. Carter, J as in Jerry, S as in Sam, Carter.com, and you can purchase the book there. You can also write me there. And I thank you for your support, and I wish all of you and Vincent richest blessings.
And of course, ladies and gentlemen, if you wish continued broadcasts like this to exist in this world, everybody has to play their part. Now, some of you, I know you have slave jobs, I know the hours are long, and I know you get stuck in traffic and you have to deal with all of this crap and what have you. And perhaps you've got kids, other time commitments and things like that. You can't contribute to the so-called truth movement in ways such as having a radio show and what have you, because you just don't have the time. But you do have, a lot of you, just a little bit of spare resources to donate to the people who are doing that important work in your stead, people like myself, people like Michael. And if you're spending your hard-earned cash on good things rather than poisons and scumbaggery and donating to political parties that consistently lie to everybody and only follow the diktats of its largest donors, then support people like us, and you're inherently supporting all the people like you as well. So please go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and donate or start up a regular donation gift today. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening.